Work Week. This is Steve Zeltzer. This morning we'll go to Seadrift, Texas, and interview environmental activist and injured worker advocate Diane Wilson. Wilson has been on a hunger strike along with others to stop the Valero Oil Company from bringing tar sands to Texas to process at the refinery. Next, we will look at the struggle of the Mi Pueblo food workers who are fighting for justice at 30 Northern California Mi Pueblo food stores, including in San Jose and Oakland. These immigrant workers face the ICE and owners as they fight for their union rights. January 1st was the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation by President Abraham Lincoln. We will look at the history and the relevance of that anniversary for working people today with an interview of historian and Columbia professor Eric Foner. We will have our Workweek calendar as well. Welcome back to Work Week. This is Steve Zeltzer, the host. Diane Wilson is a shrimp fisherwoman, writer, and longtime environmental and injured worker advocate who lives in Cedar, Texas, near the Texas Gulf Coast Oil Industry Panhandle. She's the founder of the Texas Injured Workers United and has been on hunger strike against the Valero Oil Company and the plan to import tar sands from Canada into Texas. She is also the author of An Unreasonable Woman, A True Story of Shrimpers, Politicos, Polluters, and the Fight for Seadrift, Texas. Welcome to the show, Diane.
Thank you, Steve. I'm glad to be here.
So, Diane, what is going on in your struggle in Texas around the tar sands and Valero?
Well, basically, it's a real fight. It's like a physical fight. It's like there's a number of camps where they're doing hands-on action, you know, like whether it's barricading themselves inside the pipelines, whether it's putting themselves in these kind of like teepees 80 to 100 foot in the air. I think this has been going on now probably over 90 days. And I know I've been with the camp that's been in Houston, and I've been on a hunger strike for 40 days now. And the first day I started out, I chained my neck to one of their trucks outside of Valero. So basically, it's whatever you can do to stop the tar sands, and the theory is to literally try to bring it to a halt in however way you can. And there is a lot of retaliation. The cops down here, I mean, they are charging these young kids who sometimes do nothing more than try to take water to some of the people that are doing the action. I mean, they're charging them with felonies, and they're putting like $60,000 bonds on them. And you know, I think one of the last kids, I mean, they had been in jail for like 25 days just because they couldn't come up with the bond money to get out of jail. So it is a frontline battle. There's nothing nice about it at all.
Well, they call that, I understand, Texas justice.
Oh, yeah. We love to call that Texas justice.
Now, you're, from the Gulf Coast. It's a major oil industry there, and you're the organizer, one of the founders of a group, Texas Injured Workers United. What are the conditions for workers in the refineries, and is there a lot of illness and sickness because of these chemicals and pollutants?
Well, I tell you how bad it is. If I am a shrimper, I am an activist. I have been fighting these chemical companies, and it is so bad that the workers come to me. They don't go to OSHA. They don't go to the state environmental agencies. They don't go to the politicians. They certainly don't go to the corporation. They come. I'm probably the last person on the list that a worker would come to. And they come to me. And it's because, one, they can't get any help from the corporation. I mean, all the company wants to do is fire them. You know, I've had one worker that, and she worked all night up on this tower, and then she fell. And then the company, you know, it's right to work down here, and they fired her, and they said, oh, she'd been drinking on the job. Yeah, 2 o'clock in the morning, up on a tower, she had been drinking. And they just fire them if they happen, because there are so many chemicals that are extremely toxic. I mean, they can cause cancer. I mean, like, one of the ones we work with is vinyl chloride down here. And if they get tests that show their liver enzymes are up, it's like suddenly you're out of a job. And the workers don't know who to go to. And like I said, there is, because of exposure, which is a lot of what the tar sands workers, you know, inside these refineries are going to be dealing with, and the workers inside of these petrochemical and these oil industries are constantly exposed to, is this exposure. And I mean, if you read any of the statistics on it, is these guys, one, they usually don't even get reported, because if there is one thing that is a bald-faced lie, is when a corporation puts on their little sign outside their facility and it said, not a single work loss in 2 years, that is the biggest lie you're ever going to come across, because workers are injured, they're exposed all the time. I know I had one of the companies down here, is like they had a what was it, a 10,000-pound release of hydrochloric acid, and they didn't report it. But, it, you know, matter of fact, I had reported it, so it's in the news. So OSHA had to go down there and do an inspection. And they ended up fining the company $330,000 for all of these violations. And the company, the very next day, they said, well, we may have a $330,000 fine, but we have not had a single work loss in 2 years. And I knew that was the biggest lie. So what I did was I went down and did a FOIA, a Freedom of Information request on the ambulance service. And I got 100 pages for 3 months. So it's like, The workers are under some of the worst conditions. I think people have no idea, because workers are intimidated. They're harassed. You can talk to any injured workers group to find out really how bad they are harassed. I know the workers in the plants around here, if you want to get yourself fired, just bring up a safety issue.
They're okay. Like,
do not bring up safety issues.
Okay, we've been speaking with Diane Wilson. She's been on a hunger strike against the Valero refinery. They're trying to bring in tar sands in Texas near Houston, and she's fighting for a healthy and safe environment for the workers at that tar sands, and also for the community who are affected by the chemical pollutants in that area. So is there a website that people can go to, Diane, to get more information about your hunger strike and the fight against Valero?
Yeah, they can go to tarsandsblockade.org, and there's a Facebook and also a website.
And your Injured Workers United? You have
TexasInjuredWorkers.org.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And
this
is obviously not just a local fight, a national and international fight around the tar sands. So thanks for joining us this morning, and get well.
Thank you, Steve. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you. Next. We're going to be, this is KPFA Radio, FM 94.1, and we're going to have a music break and then come, no music break. Okay, well, we're going to be coming now to our second segment, which is on the struggle of the Mi Pueblo workers. The immigrant workers are organizing a union and trying to defend their rights at 30 stores in Northern California in a chain called Mi Pueblo. And joining us is UFCW Local 5 organizer Gerardo Domingo, former Mi Pueblo worker Blanco Castano, labor writer and supporter of the Mi Pueblo workers Gino Pepe and David Herrera. All welcome to the show. Thank you this morning.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, thank you.
Hello.
Good. Now, first of all, why don't we talk about the Mi Pueblo chain? Apparently, the owner himself used to be a immigrant worker, Juvenal Chavez. Chain?
Juvenal Chavez came to the United States as an undocumented worker. He was legalized in 1986 by Ronald Reagan. Not personally, but almost. There was a legalization process for undocumented workers there that was signed by Ronald Reagan. Now, he's turned around and is using immigration procedures like I-9 audits, like E-Verify and I-9 to control the workers at these 30 supermarkets from San Rafael through the East Bay, down through San Jose, the Marina Monterey County, and down to the Central Valley. He's trying to control those workers so that they don't organize against sexual harassment, unsafe working conditions.
For their rights. Now, I've heard that his hero is Sam Walton of the Walmart chain?
Yes. According to Gerardo, who we should get on the line, Juvenal was a former executive at Walmart stores, and that Juvenal in one of his houses, he's got four between California and Mexico, at least that we know of, he has a statue of Sam Walmart or the one, whatever, Sam Walton.
Walton,
I always.
So that's his hero.
That's his hero.
Okay. Also joining us is Gerardo Domingo with UFCW Local 5. Welcome to the show, Gerardo.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
Yes. So it seems like this owner of Mi Pueblo Stores has an agenda of following in the footsteps of Walmart. Is that the case?
Yes, it is. But let me clarify one thing. Juvenal Chavez was not an executive of Walmart. The executives of Walmart that used to work at Mi Pueblo are Richard Dunkers, who happened to be the guy who created the grocery division of Walmart. He was at one time the CEO of Mi Pueblo. He was fired after we rallied against Mi Pueblo for hiring him. And now the current chief operation manager of Mi Pueblo, his name is Vince Alvarado. He also happens to be a former Walmart executive. So what we are seeing is literally the Walmartization of the Latino markets in our area. And obviously we know the formula of Walmart, pay the workers low wages and maximize your profits, right?
Yes, we were speaking with Gerardo Domingo. He's with UFCW Local 5. And also joining us this morning is Blanco Castano. Welcome to the show, Blanco.
Hi.
Now, you worked at these stores in Mi Pueblo. What happened to you when you were working there?
Well, a lot of things happened in there. I used to be a regular worker. They gave me a better work in there. I used to work in Pittsburgh, California, when the store was new. They were very excited for me because they seemed to be very organized. They seemed to be very respectful with the employees, and everything was very well. But at the pass of the days, we started seeing like different things not perfect, not good at all. I quit because I saw too many things I didn't like. I used to be the manager of the cremeria in there. And they made me do some things I wasn't good at all. They tried to To put the ladies who doesn't look well or who doesn't work as well as they want to fire them or to move them to another department. So I never did things like that. And also, after I quit, I keep hearing things from my coworkers, my ex-coworkers. Some of them as well, they quit because they were sexual harassment.
And how were they being sexually harassed?
Well, like, I don't know who to blame, but they seem like being very involved with the workers, but they don't. They let like the management of the departments just for the regular workers. So like this lady who is still working in Pittsburgh Town, the guy who was in charge of them, he asked her to go out with him, and she never agreed. So she takes some hours off from her. It used to be like, because no one gets 40 hours per week, it has to be like 35 or less, because they don't want to pay overtime.
I've heard that at Walmart. That's the Walmart method. You know, you have people of less hours, so you don't get coverage with your health care, you don't get benefits and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So.
Well, there is exceptions, like the holidays. They agree to give a little more overtime hours. But, well, it was this case. The man was trying to get her out with him, but she never wants to. He kept taking more hours from his regular schedule, and then he make her do things like she doesn't have to do it, and some things like that, and until she quit.
So retaliation. Yeah. Also joining us is David Herrera. Welcome to the show, David. And you were also a worker at Mi Pueblo?
No, I'm a part of the Dignidad and Resistencia.
I see.
The coalition.
Now the issue of immigrant workers, there's a large number of immigrant workers in this country, obviously, and the ICE and other agencies are being used, apparently, to retaliate against workers who want to join a union. That's a great fear for immigrant workers, that if they do organize a union, if they do go on strike, they will be harassed or retaliated by the employer and the government. What's the story with that?
Well, in the case of Mi Pueblo, early August, the company announced that it was implementing the E-Verify program, which basically, to check the papers of new hires. And they promised the current employees that they were not going to be E-Verified because it only applied to new hires. Then at the end, the very first week of October of last year, they said, oh, by the way, we have a 9-9 audit. So we don't exactly, what was the sequence of things from from point A to point B? But one thing we know, as we speak, we expect a lot of people getting fired because obviously many of them, they don't have a regular legal status. But at the same time, since many of the workers have signed union authorization cards, many workers have joined us in rallies and marches. We believe that also Mi Pueblo is using this as a way to stop them from organizing a union. In Oakland, we have seen so many things in terms of the verification of workers and the silent rate, which is called the I-9. And the workers have been gradually getting really scared. And, this is exactly what happened when workers want to organize and improve working conditions and when they are facing an unfair immigration system. And the worker and the employer in the middle, maybe manipulating the situation. And I say maybe because I don't have a proof that Nepal is doing it, but we suspect that it is the case.
And we're speaking with Gerardo Domingo with UFCW Local 5. Now, Anna, your husband used to work at the Pacific Casting here in Berkeley, and he apparently and others were fired, and then the company used the INS to go after them?
Yes, my husband is David.
Okay, David, why don't you talk about that? You worked at Pacific Casting. What happened there?
He doesn't speak very good in English.
My wife can explain it much better. Before.
Okay, but you were fighting for better conditions, a decent contract, and then you were harassed, and the company, the owner, used the INS to to go after you. You want to talk about that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Yes. We both work on Pacific Steel as well. Mm-hmm. We just passed for the first the E-Verify, and then we realized it was an I-9 audit, and that happened when we were under a strike. Yeah, we were like for 1 week. We were trying to get better payments, better health insurance. Not better, but the same, because they were trying to make them worse. During that time, they post an E-Verify poster in the office. After that, that was on the first month on 2011. Yeah, and then in May, they let us know that it was an I-9 audit. Yeah.
So you're actually struggling to defend your conditions.
Yes.
Get decent rights, decent conditions and benefits, and all of a sudden, the INS and the yeah. these different audits of the Obama administration come into effect. Gino, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, 2 points. One, it's not the INS anymore. It's ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They're the ones that do that. Do you get an ICE raid? You get frozen by ICE. The other point is that when there are ongoing labor disputes, such as occurred at Pacific Steel Casting, and in particularly when workers are organizing, such as occurring at Mi Pueblo, under federal regulations and under the executive order created by Obama to implement E-Verify, those programs are not supposed to be used to inhibit workers from organizing and discouraging workers from organizing, which is exactly what Juvenal Chavez is doing. In addition to that, at Mi Pueblo, Juvenal Chavez volunteered to participate in E-Verify. In California is one of the states in the country where E-Verify is not mandatory. And Juvenal Chavez volunteered to participate. And one of the things we're asking for in the Dignity and Resistance Coalition is for him to get out of it.
Okay, you were listening to Gino Pepe. He's a activist, writer, and supporter of the Mi Pueblo workers. Also joining us is Gerardo Domingo and David Herrera and Anna Castano. Now, Gerardo, has this use of the ICE and repressive tactics against workers a common thing among immigrant workers in Northern California where you're trying to organize?
Oh, yeah, it is very common. We have found so many different cases in which as soon as the employer finds out that the workers are trying to organize a union, immediately he or she begins to implement the E-Verify, or at least the threat of implementing E-Verify and the I-9 audits. In an extreme case, and I call it extreme because it's very rare, at least in my experience, there is an attorney in the Central Valley who retaliates against workers who are trying to file charges or trying to organize against the employer, trying to organize, and he calls ICE himself. And he tells ICE what's going on with the workers, where they live, so on and so forth. So if they're in the middle of a labor dispute, or at least in four occasions, workers have been deported from, if they're standing on a gas station or they're ready to go into a court, suddenly ICE appears and they're gone. So this is outrageous. This is crazy, and we are trying to stop it. But at the same time, in Oakland, when it comes to Mi Pueblo, we have heard managers using the threat of E-Verify on current employees who may not have a legal status. So what happened? Workers get terrified. Workers, just the simple thought of saying, I may be deported, I may lose my family, I may never see them again, so on and so forth. So this is really terrifying for them.
Okay, well, we have to end the debate, the discussion rather, but I want to thank all of you for coming in. And you have had actions, you've had pickets and demonstrations, and there needs obviously to be a solidarity and education campaign to defend the workers and immigrant workers, particularly at Mi Pueblo and many other stores and operations. operations where workers want a right, want justice, want human rights, want health care, and faced the kind of repression and attack. So thanks for joining us this morning. We'll try to cover this again because it's an ongoing issue. Thank you for joining us. And this is KPFA Radio, Steve Zeltzer, Work Week. Now we're going to go to a music break.
We shall fight them on the beaches. We shall fight them on the shore. They will bring us exploitation. We'll bring them their class war. And we'll lock down to the gates as they're spreading vicious lies. They want to dominate the world, and we see through their disguise. If they'd have one big multinational with their corporate flag unfurled, searching everywhere for the lowest wages in the world, then we'll have one big union from Melbourne to Prague to Seattle town. Wherever they may go, we will shut them down. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down. Got the chorus yet? That's it. That's it. CNN will spread the lies. This is just how it's gotta be. Well, they can have their CNN, 'cause we've got our IMC, and we'll tell the truth quite clearly, though they don't wanna hear it, and they'll try to stop our broadcasts, 'cause the truth is that they fear it. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down. We'd have a world full of strip malls, plants grown by biotech.
That was Dave Rovics. This is Steve Zeltzer with Workweek Radio. Next, we're going to be going to a segment of an interview done at the recent affiliation conference of the CNA and NUHW. Kay McVeigh, who is a registered nurse and is the former president emeritus of the CNA, NNOC, and NNU, she was interviewed about how she sees this upcoming election representation struggle at Kaiser and the issues facing healthcare workers. She spoke about the SEIU-UHW and its leader, Dave Regan, and why she sees a dangerous threat to healthcare workers in California. So let's go to that interview.
I've been an RN for over 50 years. I've worked at Kaiser for very many years. What I'm seeing is that the whole of the industry, the Sutters, the Kaisers, the Catholic Healthcare, all of them are wanting to push the nursing back to when I first came out of nursing school back in 1957. We can't allow that to happen. I was very active in taking over CNA so that it would be for the nurses and would be run by bedside nurses. What we have accomplished in those years is fabulous. I mean, it took a lot of work, but we got ratios for the bedside nurse, which meant better care for the patient. We were able to put in the word advocacy for patients in the Nurse Practice Act so that it is a demand, legal demand, that RNs do advocate for their patients. It's extremely important. What I'm watching is a combined effort to get rid of bedside nurses. If this SEIU-UHW, whatever its name is, I can't pronounce it correctly, I'm sure, is successful, you won't have a nurse at your bedside. We'll not have the experience. We'll not have the knowledge to be able to help you. This is so important to us. It really is. Because the goal of this particular group, Mr. Reagan, is to destroy ratios, to destroy lift teams, to destroy everything that we have worked for to ensure that the patients would be cared for better. I'm very worried about it because I've been in the past and I know what it was like, and I don't want to see it to go back there. You know, finally, the RNs are making a decent wage. I retired from bedside nursing in 95. I didn't have a defined benefit. So my Social Security is $660. That tells you how much money I made in my career. I don't want to see that happen again.
Why is Dave Regan and the SEIU making these deals and kind of going along with concession bargaining?
You know, I really don't know. I have a theory, but it's just my theory. But I think that it's very detrimental to workers, to his own workers. I mean, this is one of the reasons why, you know, we looked at everything that has happened, all the issues that were talked about, and the Me Too in the language. And it really is. It's sad. You know, if I lose my health care benefit as a retiree, what is that going to mean to me? It means that I maybe have 6 months or 8 months. It's one of those things. And for him to have allowed that to happen to the retirees, you know, yeah, they're not paying dues, so we can get rid of them.
Okay, this is Steve Zeltz again with Workweek Radio. You were listening to an interview with Kay McVeigh, who is a registered nurse and a past president of the CNA. And during the past strike, which we've covered here on Workweek, the SEIU members were told to cross the picket line that were set up at Alta Bates and other Sutter hospitals. Another issue that has come up, which is very important, is against concession bargaining by the SEIU Dave Regan, and also the issue of labor management partnerships, which are endemic, really, in the labor movement all over the country. So we're going to come back to that in the future about this issue of concession bargaining and labor management partnerships. But now we're going to go to another music segment. Was Mike Stout and When the New World Comes. On January 1st of this year, it was the 150th anniversary of the Proclamation Emancipation issued by President Lincoln. We did a recent interview with Eric Foner, who's an American historian who is focused on the U.S. Civil War. Eric Foner is a Pulitzer Prize winner, and he is a tremendous authority. Renowned authority, really, on the Civil War. We will now go to that Workweek interview. This is Steve Zeltzer with Workweek Radio, and I'm with Professor Eric Foner. He's a professor at Columbia University and one of the foremost knowledgeable people about the Civil War. And you've recently written a op-ed in the New York Times about the Proclamation of Emancipation. Why don't you talk about why you wrote that that op-ed piece, Professor?
Well, you know, I wrote it, well, partly just because I thought that the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, which occurred on January 1st the other day, needed to be commemorated in some way. I mean, it's one of the key turning points in American history. Also, I think, you know, as a historian, I'm delighted that the popular culture has taken an interest in Lincoln this year. You've had movies like Spielberg's Lincoln, Lincoln the Vampire Hunter, a different approach. And it's good that people are going to see them, but they're not history. Those movies are not history. I mean, Vampire Hunter, you can put aside. Spielberg is not history either, although it's a good movie. And, you know, I just felt people, it would be good to put out there what really happened, what led Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, what some of its consequences were, and how it represented both a key turning point for the United States, but also for Lincoln himself in the evolution of his ideas about slavery and race in America.
Now, working people at that time, the trade unions, the labor movement, and the Marxist movement were in favor of the North, of course, for the Civil War, and in favor of the freedom of the slavery. But there was opposition at that time to Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment. How did that come about, despite the opposition?
Well, you're right. Most working people in the North, in England, understood that, as Marx once wrote, you know, free labor can't really be free while other labor is in chains. And on the other hand, there was certainly a good deal of racism in the society shared by many working people. The New York City draft riots of 1863 involved a lot of Irish immigrant laborers who, you know, rioted against the draft, against the war, against black people. But there was a lot of opposition to emancipation. It came mostly from the Democratic Party. It came from sympathizers with the South. It came from people who felt that declaring the end of slavery would prolong the war. It would mean the South would never agree to a negotiated peace if they had to give up slavery. But, you know, the majority of the North became convinced, farmers, artisans, workers, merchants, others, by the middle of the war, that slavery must become a target. You were never going to win this war simply as a war of army against army. It had to become a war of society against society, so to speak, that the infrastructure, the basic institution of southern life, had to be targeted to win the war. So at the beginning of the war, there was not tremendous support for emancipation. By the time the proclamation was issued, there was far more.
And the arming of the African Americans and their inclusion into the army, the Union Army, that took place because they were basically needed to recruit them to the military.
Well,
case?
You know, this was a war at the beginning. People thought the war would be rather short, you know, not a big problem. And at the beginning, the army refused to allow black enlistments. The Emancipation Proclamation, one of the things it does is for the first time it authorizes the enrollment of black men in the Union Army. And by the end of the war, something like 200,000 men, black men, have served in the Union Army and Navy. Most of them are former slaves. There weren't a heck of a lot of free blacks in the North. Some of them served, but it's mostly former slaves. And that is a critical thing in the Civil War. First of all, it belies the notion that some people still have that somehow white America freed the slaves. I mean, that's the basic theme of the Spielberg movie, you know, white people freeing the slaves.
Is that the reason he did not have Frederick Douglass in that
movie?
Well,
you know, that movie is dealing with basically a very short period of time in January 1865, and Frederick Douglass did not meet with Lincoln at that time, but since it's a movie, it's not history, he could have had Frederick Douglass. But even the black characters, you know, I'm not here to denounce Spielberg. It's a heck of a lot better than many other Hollywood movies. But even the black characters he does have, like Mrs. Keckley, the seamstress of and confidant of Mary Lincoln, who's probably the major black character in the movie, you know, she wasn't just a kind of ordinary, ignorant, you know, uneducated person. She was a political actor. She was the head of the Relief Society in Washington trying to give aid to fugitive slaves. You know, they don't give you any sense of that, unfortunately. But anyway, to go back to black soldiers, the service of those men changed racial attitudes in very significant ways in America. It gave them a claim to citizenship in the post-war republic. And I think it had a lot of effect on Lincoln. You know, Lincoln had shared many of the prejudices of his society before the war, but by the end of the war, he's moved very far toward notions of equality. He says black soldiers ought to have the right to vote, which was unprecedented. Nobody.
That was a radical conception at that time.
Very radical at that time of 1865. So the service of black soldiers is very critical in the evolving story of the Civil War and slavery.
And, of course, segregated military units continued even during the Second World War.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they served, those 200,000 men served in segregated units under white officers. At the beginning, they did not have equal pay, although eventually they received it. And, yes, the Army remained segregated until President Truman ordered it integrated in 1947-48. So the Korean War was the first war fought by an integrated. Well, let me take that back. The American Revolution, some blacks served in George Washington's army, and they were integrated into the army. So from the American Revolution, you had to wait then till the Korean War to have another war where black men served alongside in not segregated units, alongside white men.
And one of the debates that was taking place at that time would what would happen to the South after the war? Would there be an equal society, or would there be resegregation despite the victory?
Yeah, of course, the abolition of slavery during the war does not answer the question that you just raised about what kind of society will be built from the ashes of slavery. And, of course, this tremendous disagreement, that becomes the crux of the whole crisis of Reconstruction. You had radical Republicans in the North, like Thaddeus Stevens, who's in the movie, urging real equality, not just political equality, legal equality, but giving land to the former slaves, you know, taking it away from the owners in order to give them a economic foundation for their liberty. You had others who felt that blacks should be really a second-class group without political rights, without civil rights. They should just go back to work on the plantations and not bother anyone. That was the position of Andrew Johnson, the president who succeeded Lincoln after Lincoln was assassinated. And, of course, African Americans themselves were active players in this, and they put forward demands right from the end of the war for equal rights as American citizens. So you had a very complicated struggle in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War about what kind of society this was going to be.
And the end of Reconstruction period in the South brought back the segregationists, really, and has held back the black working class and the American working class today, actually. I mean,
we're coming up in a couple of years to the 150th anniversary of Reconstruction, and I hope people pay some attention to it, because it is a critical moment in American history. I've written a lot about it in my career, and that's the first time that there was an effort made. It didn't succeed, but a serious effort made to make this a true interracial democracy in this country. The failure of Reconstruction, as you indicated, led to the triumph of what we call Jim Crow, not just racial segregation, but many other forms of inequality, of lynching, poor education, job discrimination, housing discrimination, you name it, and, of course, taking the right to vote away from black men. And that affected American life long into the 20th century. And as you say, the residue or the legacy of it is still around us in many features of our society today. The tremendous gap in wealth between black and white Americans, the shorter life expectancy, worse health, and other characteristics of the black population are still showing the burdens of slavery and segregation.
And, of course, there are two films, as we were discussing earlier, which is very unusual, Django Unchained.
Django I have not yet seen. I expect to see it soon.
And Lincoln. Is there a reason that there happen to be two films in this 100th
anniversary? Well, the Lincoln one, of course, is, I think motivated by the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. And Django, I don't know what Tarantino's motivation is. One would have to ask him, but I don't. As I say, not having seen it, I can't really say much about it, although I understand it takes a slightly different approach to how slavery ought to be ended from the Lincoln movie.
Now, that was, slavery. But today there's a slavery that working people face. They have to sell their labor. Is there any comparison to the struggle in the Civil War and the struggle that working people faced?
Well, of course, working men and women had to sell their labor, free ones, back then. And, in fact, the labor movement in the 19th century frequently used the term wage slavery to protest against their conditions. Of course, wage slavery is a metaphor. It is not a reality. Northern workers were not slaves. They could leave their job. They could marry. They could not be sold and bought, you know. And it's a metaphor, but the metaphor is based on the notion that they didn't really control their own economic livelihoods, and that the, you know, in the economic marketplace was a very harsh taskmaster. And the notion of economic independence, which was critical to the labor movement in the 19th century, was something that most workers lacked. And lack of the ability to control your own labor was called a form of slavery. So I think, you know, that situation still exists, obviously. And, in fact, in the last 4 or 5 years under the economic recession, many more workers have found themselves, as you well know, in an extremely precarious situation. Even the ones who have not lost their jobs have found their pensions taken away, their wages depressed, their ability to join unions, you know, challenged. And, you know, I think it is obviously a serious problem in our country.
So, Professor Foner, what is really the relevance of the Civil War for the American working people today? What are the lessons of that war for the working people today?
Well, to me, it's an inspiring study. You know, I mean, look, war is a horrible thing, and the Civil War was a horrible thing. 600,000-700,000, they now estimate, men died in the Civil War, and nobody can celebrate that. On the other hand, it did produce what Lincoln called a new birth of freedom. It did produce a change in the nature of our society, the end of the terrible, horrible institution of chattel slavery. And it brought to the fore some very inspiring people like Frederick Douglass, like Thaddeus Stevens, who were pushing to really move beyond even emancipation to make this a society of equality. So I think we can learn from and be inspired by their struggle. And by many of their accomplishments, you know, they wrote into the Constitution after the war the principle of equality among Americans, which is still there. It's sometimes violated, but without the 14th Amendment, which could only have been adopted during Reconstruction, it could not be adopted today if it were, you know, put up to a vote. You would not have had some of the great struggles of the 20th century and 21st century of women's rights and black rights. They wouldn't have had a constitutional foundation. That comes out of the Civil War and Reconstruction.
And your latest book, what does it focus on?
It's called The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery, and it focuses on Lincoln's, the evolution, you might say, of Lincoln's thinking and acting about slavery. Because, again, not to criticize the movie, but, you know, that's one of the problems with the Spielberg movie. Lincoln is just there. There's no sense of where his ideas came from or how they might have changed over time. You know, before the Civil War, Lincoln was not an abolitionist. Lincoln did not believe in black equality. He was anti-slavery, absolutely. He hated slavery, but his thinking changed, he matured, he grew, and that, I think, is a fascinating story. That's the story I try to tell, and the movie just has Lincoln as a static figure with, you know, always the same, and that's not history.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. I hope to have you on again.
Great, nice to talk to you, and I'm always interested in talking about these historical questions.
And I think for working people today, the lessons of the Civil War are very important. So thanks for
Absolutely.
Joining us this morning.
Absolutely.
Thank you,
Professor. Thanks. Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Very good. Take care. Okay, welcome back to Work Week. And again, that was an interview with Professor Eric Foner. His work actually won a Pulitzer Prize about Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. And that, I think, is important, and we'll go back to it in future programs. So this is Steve Zeltser with Workweek Radio, and now we're going to have our calendar for the week of January 7th. On Tuesday, January 8th at 10 a.m., labor and community activists will be attending a meeting of the California Public Utilities Commission at 505 Van Ness at McAllister Street. They will be calling on the commission to permanently shut down the broken and dangerous San Onofre nuclear power plant. The Southern California Edison Company plans to lay off 50% of the workers and reopen the plant. For more information, go to www.nuclearfreecal.org. On Friday, on January 11th at 9 a.m. at San Francisco City College Ocean Campus next to the Diego Rivera Theater, there will be a protest against the attacks on AFT 2121 faculty, SEIU 1021 staff, and students by the new special trustee and incoming Chancellor Dr. Thelma Scott Skillman. Labor and community are fighting back against the CCSF administration, which is flagrantly violating the union contracts and attacking the conditions for students at the college. For more information on this picket and rally, you can call 510-714-8687 or KAUF, KAUFMYN at AOL.com. On Friday at 3 p.m., there will be a rally and speak out at the Japanese consulate in San Francisco at 50 Fremont Street near Mission. The new Japanese government under Prime Minister Abe has stated they want to reopen all of Japan's 50 nuclear plants, and there has been growing repression, including the arrest of a professor, anti-nuclear activist and professor in Osaka. For more information, go to http://nonukes.wordpress.com. On January the 18th through January 20th, it will be the 2013 Western Workers Labor Heritage Festival, honoring Martin Luther King at the IEM Hall, Local 1781, at 1511 Rollins Road in Burlingame, California. They will also be commemorating the life of John Fromer, who is an important labor troubadour in Northern California and passed away and has been a longtime activist and musical inspiration to many people, as well as writer. For more information on the Western Workers Labor Heritage Festival, go to www.westernworkersfestival.org. On Saturday, January 19th at 2 p.m., there will be a public forum on privatization, public education, and education unions. It will be held at 518 Valencia Street near 16th Street and is sponsored by United Public Workers for Action, www.upwa.info. For more information on Workweek Radio, contact info@wwradio.org. Thanks to our board operator, Kristen Thomas, line producer, Cosme Torrey. This is Steve Zeltzer with Workweek Radio, KPFA, KPFB, 88.1, KFCF on Fresno. Solidarity.